The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back. Tuesday, April 23rd, 2024. I am Seth Leibson. Mr. Bill, good to see you. Young David, back in the commander's chair. Good to see you after your victorious golf impresario nature yesterday.
Yes, I'm back in the captain's chair.
Did you drink enough liquids? It was hot out there, huh?
I drank water. No other liquids.
No other liquids. No electrolytes. Nothing other.
Just water.
No OH infusions. Okay, good.
There were no other liquid substances consumed.
No other liquids
while I was working.
Or gaseous ones, I assume. Well, we have a lot to catch up on in your absence, including, I think, a distillation that we're going to require of you and is required of you on the anniversary, which was yesterday, of Richard Milhouse.
I know. I came in late in the second hour yesterday. I was checking in at the office, and I thought I'd run down to the studio next door and see how things were going.
Yeah.
And I expected to hear you on a three-hour crusade to talk about the 30th anniversary of Richard Nixon's death. And what do I find? Lumberjack songs.
Well, because you were dressed like a lumberjack.
And I did it again today just to prove my point.
It's okay. Matt Walsh does it, and he's a pretty smart guy. And Lamar Alexander made famous that lumberjack shirt, the one that Matt Walsh so often wears. Are you familiar with the Lamar?
Black.
Yeah,
yes.
The red and black.
I don't know what they call
Lamar
that.
Exclamation point. We'll get into all of that. Alicia Finley in the Wall Street Journal, probably the most interesting regular writer they have there, always worth reading. She writes, "How did our world culture and politics become such a mess?" A simple explanation can be found in the best-selling children's picture book series, If You Give, by Laura Joffe Numeroff. In each story, indulging a creature's unreasonable requests, be it for a cookie, a muffin, or a pancake, stimulate an appetite for more. It stimulates appetites for more. So it goes in real life. If college students ask for safe spaces, you might give affinity groups their own centers. Then they'll want to feel safe in classrooms and will ask for trigger warnings to protect them from ideas they don't like. When you agree that certain ideas can be dangerous, students will occupy buildings and demand that speakers be canceled. When you apologize and disinvite speakers, students ask you to excuse tardy and incomplete assignments because they were busy protesting. When you give them an A for no effort, they will graduate with honors and think they don't have to work hard to succeed. Then, when you give them a job, they'll ask to work only 30 hours a week. If you say yes, they'll use their extra time to organize a union. If you recognize their union, they'll ask for extra paid days off and 8 weeks vacation. When they max out their credit cards, they'll ask for their student loans to be forgiven. When you cancel their debt, they'll quit their jobs to get graduate degrees in community organizing. When they can't repay their graduate loans, they'll ask for more debt forgiveness. If a hungry migrant shows up at your border, he will ask for asylum. When you let him into the country, he will ask for a place to stay. When you give him free room and board at a Manhattan hotel, he will invite his family and friends. When you let them in, they'll ask for a bus to New York. If an electric vehicle startup asks for government support, you might agree to fund the construction of its first factory. Then it will want tax credits for people to buy its cars. Since drivers need to charge their EVs, the company will ask you to finance charging stations. When it keeps losing money, it'll ask you to subsidize its battery manufacturing. When it produces more EVs than people want to buy, it'll ask you to ban gasoline-powered cars so consumers will have no other choice but to buy them. Then it'll ask for more money to build factories to make more EVs that people are forced to buy. If you create a child tax credit, liberals will demand that it be made more generous. When you increase the credit, they'll ask to make it refundable so people who don't owe taxes can claim it. When some stop working, they'll ask to increase the earned income tax credit as an incentive to work. Then they'll ask for paid family leave to make it easier for parents to take time off work. When inflation increases because of government spending, liberals will ask for a bigger child tax credit. If Iranian mullahs ask for relief from economic sanctions, you may go along because you want them to agree. You want them to agree to a new deal to limit their nuclear weapons program. When you give them sanctions relief, they'll spend their bounty on manufacturing weapons, which they will give to terrorist proxies to attack Israel. Then the mullahs will ask for more sanctions relief, which you'll grant because you believe it'll encourage them to be less belligerent. Then they'll manufacture more weapons, which their proxies will use to launch more attacks. When you ask Israel to stand down, the mullahs will continue manufacturing weapons and enriching uranium. Then they'll ask for the abolition of Israel in return for not launching a nuclear weapon. If Israel removes its citizens from Gaza, Hamas will take over and ask for humanitarian assistance. When you send aid, Hamas will use it for military purposes while impoverishing its people. Then it'll use Gazans as human shields after launching attacks on Israel. And when Israel tries to defend itself, innocent Gazans will accidentally get killed. The United Nations will lambast Israel as the aggressor. Hamas will smile and ask for more humanitarian relief. When you give Hamas more aid, it will launch yet more attacks on Israel and take civilians hostage. When you seek to negotiate the release, Hamas will ask for more aid and a temporary ceasefire. When you agree, it will regroup. Then when Israel accidentally kills Gazans while trying to eradicate Hamas terrorists, radical leftists will block traffic on U.S. bridges and demand a permanent ceasefire. When you agree, Hamas will escalate its attacks. When Israel fights back, the college protesters will ask for safe spaces for Hamas. And the list goes on. Indeed, it does. And I think that that is a perfectly beautiful way to capture what happens when you give a mouse some cheese. But when you apply it, more importantly, to the public policy of our age, and when you're talking about our college students and the appeasement of them. It reminds one a little bit of that wonderful speech William Buckley gives in The Unmaking of a Mayor, right, where he is talking about what happens to the woman who simply is trying to put her children to bed at night and earn a living. It's a beautiful rendering, but anyway, we are at an odd place, and the place we are at is one where the students are now in charge. The students are in charge of the adults, and the inmates have taken over the asylum with a lot of willing allied executioners. These college professors, particularly at Columbia and New York University, are interesting to me. For the most part, they stand with the students, but refuse to take questions from reporters, journalists that go up to them to ask them what it is they are defending, what it is they are protesting, what it is they are standing for. Interesting that these professors who supposedly have something to profess or something to stand in unity with the students don't want their message to be put on the news. Why is that? Why is it they only want to stand in public in their little anatevkas of these college universities and campuses? And that's precisely the answer. It's buried within the question. They have built these little anatevkas that are unaccountable to the world at large, where they think they can do anything they want. The mayor of New York, the mayor, Eric Adams, he doffed his hat to that point by saying, as he did yesterday, that we will not enter the universities unless we are invited to do so. That is to say, given our police will not enter the universities to break up any of these protests or illegal sit-ins because they are private property. This is a pass you have given as a mayor and as a police force to no other possessor or owner of private property. This is an absurd point that seems to only make sense in the context of the college campus. And of course, it makes sense only in the context of these very kinds of protests. For indeed, if a college campus were protecting a student who, or a professor, or an administrator, or anyone on its property who were engaging in almost any other form of illegal activity, the last thing the police and the mayor would say is, we need your invitation, we need your permission to come in. It doesn't do this with households where abuses are taking place, or perhaps other illegal activity. And it doesn't do it with business office complexes. It doesn't do it with any other form of private property in America. Now, make that private property funded by state and federal dollars, and you are implying and invoking any number of laws that are being violated on these campuses with your endowments. Not talking about their wealthy college endowments. I'm talking about your endowments, because you are paying tax dollars to subsidize these students and this tyranny. I'm Seth Liebson, 602-508-0960. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Liebson Show, 602-508-0960. Hat tip to Hugh Hallman. He'll be joining us a little bit later with Lewis. For sending that Alicia Finley piece to me in the Wall Street Journal. She's critical reading. Whenever you see her byline, Alicia Finley, read it. Same with if you get a New York Times subscription, read Pamela Paul. She is an interesting liberal who usually ends up writing very conservative, or at least conservative things in a very smart way. Pamela Paul and Alicia Finley, probably the two writers I've discovered in the past couple of years at these two major newspapers, who have maybe some of the brightest ink in their pens. Young David, you want to defend yourself sartorially. I shall let you do that.
To defend myself sartorially?
Yeah.
With regards to yesterday, you mean?
And today a little bit.
Oh, my goodness. When you assaulted me and my outfit yesterday, and you said—
I described it. I didn't insult it. I said you were dressed like a lumberjack. It was a description.
It was a description. That may be so. But I was also dressed like a golfer, and you didn't believe me. And I pulled pictures of Bob Hope and Bing Crosby and Groucho Marx all wearing plaid shirts on the golf course. I think you owe me lunch.
Yeah, I probably do. I probably do. I should
put some of these on Twitter.
I thought your pants today were Dennis the Menace pajamas with the back flap.
Gosh.
It turns out
they're 1944 Marine Corps trousers
that
I got for all of $10 surplus.
This is why Sam Stone says you're the oldest young person he's ever met. 1940s trousers.
Yes. Yes.
Well, you know, it's interesting. People sometimes ask, were you born in the right decade, or what decade would you have been born in, or should you have been born in? And I think it's probably fair to say that you were, like I think I probably was, were born in decades that didn't really represent our camaraderie, our contemporaries, right?
That is true. However, when people accuse me of this, I always like to point out that I was born in an era in which I can sample from the past.
Yeah.
If I was born, let's say, in 1866 in Kansas and died, about 1914 at the ripe old age of 40-something, I would never have experienced anything besides my immediate surroundings. I have the technology of the day in order to appeal to that of the past. If I want to, I can pull up an opera from the 1700s in a matter of seconds on my cell phone. And I couldn't have done that, depending on where and when I was born in this country. So when people say, oh, you were born in the wrong era, it's like, well, you know what? I was born in an era when I can appreciate the past, because in some eras... the current was all they had to choose from.
Yeah, I think it's that respect for the past that's so damn interesting and such a problem with people who might be within 10 years of you on either side of you. There's a lack of respect for it. And by respect, I don't mean unwavering support for. By respect, I mean education from, learning from. Just because something is old, obviously, it doesn't mean it's good. And just because something is old doesn't mean it's bad. Just because something is new doesn't mean it's good. Just because something is new doesn't mean it's bad. It's a little bit like the story at the end of Charlie Wilson's War. We'll see, right? Said the Zen master about every little eventuation. We'll see. We could take and use technology today as the example that you put forward and that we are still struggling and wrestling with. Are we a better people because of the advent of certain parts of technology? maybe time will tell. Yes, in our hands we have access to a wider array of knowledge than at any time before. I mean, we have in the palms of our hands access to libraries vaster than the Library of Alexandria, and we can download for ourselves or find for ourselves information that one could never have gleaned 15 or 20 years ago, even if they went to a library or had a reference librarian. Do you remember when we grew up? I don't know if I'm the only one in the audience who remembers this, but I do remember this, that if we couldn't find a piece of information out at the dinner table and it wasn't in our encyclopedia, and every house I knew had an encyclopedia. I don't know houses that have them now. I don't know if you – I don't know if if there is needed, but there is something about the book form, just as there is something about still having a hard copy of the OED – though it's accessible online. But if we couldn't find out something from the encyclopedia and someone at the dinner table was unaware, do you know what we used to do, young David? We would call the library and we would ask for a reference librarian.
You'd call them.
We would call them with our rotary phones, which most people don't know what those are anymore. We would call them with our rotary phones and be put on hold as they got a reference librarian. A reference librarian was someone who would take those calls and look up a fact for you. That's how we used to do it when I was growing
up. And how is
it
the day that they work?
Yeah, they weren't working until the wee small hours, that's for certain. But you could call them probably up to 7 o'clock or 8 o'clock at night. I remember very vividly doing this, excusing ourselves from the dinner tables to call a reference librarian. It was one of the few reasons you could get up and excuse yourself from the dinner table. But let me not lose the larger point about technology being an example. Yes, it gives you the access to understand the 1940s and to see Bob Hope in a plaid shirt, but and of course other more meaningful things. But we're also learning that it comes with a cost. It comes with a tremendous cost because any good thing, as Roger Scruton wrote, any good thing can be used for a bad purpose. Any good thing can be turned into a bad thing. And I don't know if that final chapter has been written about the internet, or at least smartphones in the hands of young people. I think quickly those final chapters are being written primarily from the great work of Jonathan Haidt and others who have been reading and understanding and assimilating his work and what is done to the mind of a young person once they become so addicted to their smartphones, to their screens generally, and not just phones. They can be desktops and laptops. But would we want to do without it? Is it a transactional cost for a greater advancement, that we have more power in our hands, more intelligence in our hands, more computing firepower in our hands than did our first flight and landing to the moon? It's an awful lot of power, and as Roger Scruton was pointing out, it can be used for ill or for good. And though we invented it for good, the challenge now is to keep it on the path for the use of good. I'll have more to say about that, and I want to read you something about what's going on our campuses as well from one of the best writers in the world. I'm Seth Leibson, 602-508-0960. We'll be right back. One of the most important and best writers in the world is Brendan O'Neill. He's the chief political writer at Spiked, SPIKED-online.com. Critical reading. He's as gifted a writer as Christopher Hitchens or Douglas Murray. He writes, hands down, the worst take on the Gaza. And by the way, yes, I notice they're all British. Hands down, the worst take on the Gaza Solidarity encampment that has taken over Columbia University in New York City for the past week is that students have always done things like this. Students have forever occupied buildings and quads to make a political point. Students have long agitated against war. Students often find themselves in the grip of passionate radical intensity. Look at the Vietnam era, says every columnist in Christendom, as if the Gaza camp were just another explosion of youthful anti-imperialism. The willful naivete of this take is unforgivable. To liken Columbia's strange, seething pro-Palestine camp to earlier campus uprisings against militarism is to gloss over what is new here. It is to whitewash the profoundly unsettling nature of this rage of the privileged against the world's only Jewish state. Until someone can point me to instances of those 60s anti-war kids hurling racist invective at minority groups and demanding the wholesale destruction of a small state overseas, I'll be giving their Gaza camp commentary a wide berth. The camp might look and sound like student politics as normal, with its juvenile bluster, megaphone virtue, and the occasional appearance of pitiable university officials warning campers of suspension. But scratch the radical surface and you'll swiftly find an ugly underbelly of reactionary cries and even outright racism. No sooner had the students erected their tent city for Palestine last Wednesday than it became a magnet for genocidal dreaming about the erasure of Israel and plain old bigotry against Jews. Columbia has rang out with cries of, quote, "We don't want no two states, we want all of it," close quote. You don't need to be an expert in Middle East affairs to decipher this demand. It's a sick call to seize the entirety of Israel, all of it, and create a new state more in keeping with the Israelophobic yearnings of both privileged Westerners and radical Islamists. Their longing for Israel's erasure was made even clearer in the follow-up chant, quote, "We don't want no two states, we want 48, close quote. That is 1948, a time when the modern state of Israel didn't exist. They want a world without Israel. They want to lay waste to the national home of the Jews. This isn't anti-imperialism. It's an imperious demand by the privilege of the West for the eradication of a state they hate. These people bleat about Israel's ethnic cleansing in Gaza, yet it is ethnic cleansing they themselves desire. As Democratic Congressman Richie Torres has said of this chant, turning the clock back to 1948 means wiping Israel off the map. For months, Israel phobes have insisted that their slogan, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, is not a call to erase Israel. We can now see through that lie. We want all of it rips the mask from their fake anti-war posturing and reveals the nuclear-level loathing for the Jewish state that lurks beneath. Unsurprisingly, such feverish hatred for the Jewish nation can morph with startling speed into open loathing for the Jewish people. We've seen this around the Columbia camp, too. When counter-protesters turned up waving the Israeli flag, one of the pro-Palestine agitators cried, quote, "Uncultured, word I can't say, go back to Europe," close quote. The Jews were taunted with yells of, "Go back to Poland." Not content with cleansing the Middle East of Jews, some also want to cleanse America of these problematic people. It's fascistic hate masquerading as anti-militarism. Indeed, the anti-militarist mask has well and truly come off this movement. The Columbia camp makes clear as day that Israel haters want more war, not less. "Burn Tel Aviv to the ground," bigots chanted. "Go Hamas, we love you," said others. Nothing better captures the crisis of Western civilization than this vision of trust fund, gender-fluid, blue-haired kids singing the praises of a movement that would hurl them from a top-floor window given half a chance. In one especially nauseating incident, a white girl in a keffiyeh was seen holding a placard with an arrow saying, "Al-Qassam's next targets," referring to the Al-Qassam Brigades, which is the military wing of Hamas. The placard's arrow was pointed toward Jewish students waving the Israeli flag. Shorter version, "Hamas, kill these people." How swiftly the anti-fascists become fascists. Brenton O'Neill has more. I'll share it with you when we come right back. Welcome back to the Seth Liebson Show. The folks at the Midas Gold Group have told me the U.S. government and the Fed will have no choice but to eventually steer interest rates lower, because if they don't, the current level of interest rates will bankrupt the nation. And there's no telling when the dam will break, but when it does, Midas wants to make sure you have flood insurance, in this case gold. Call Midas Gold Group now. Look into the opportunities gold can provide you as a way to diversify your investments. Call 480-360-3000 or go to MidasGoldGroup.com. Midas Gold Group is the nation's number one veteran-owned gold IRA firm. Protect your assets. Call 480-360-3000. That's 480-360-3000. Midas Gold Group, always faithful. MidasGoldGroup.com. I'm reading Brenton O'Neill's piece where he says how swiftly the anti-fascists become fascists. Media elite sympathizers with Colombia's Gaza camp claim these pro-Hamas cries, these demands for the obliteration of Israel, and this hanging of target signs around the necks of Jews are rare occurrence in an otherwise peaceful protest. Plus, it's mostly outsiders, they say. I call baloney. If you create a space in which anti-Semites feel comfortable, so comfortable that they're happy to openly glorify Hamas's cosmic racist violence, then that's on you. What's more, the insistence that it's only a few voices celebrating 7 October, just a handful of agitators who are cheering the rape, kidnap, and murder of Jews, is desperate, bordering on sick. That there are any such voices in and around one of the highest seats of learning in modern America should be viewed as unsettling in the extreme. Anyone who cares for the future of academia and for the future of the West should be alarmed that at Columbia, the College of Alexander Hamilton, of Amelia Earhart, of Barack Obama, people have been heard saying to Jews that October 7th is coming every day for you. President Biden is right. This is blatant anti-Semitism. We need to be honest about what is happening at Columbia. This is solidarity with a pogrom. It is sympathy for fascism. It is privileged leftists getting a cheap moral kick from a mass act of racist violence against Jews that they catastrophically mistake for a blow against imperialism. It is the socialism of fools. More than that, it is a howl of rage against civilization. This rancid camp with its flashes of outright Jew hate is not an extension of the anti-war activism of old. It's an extension of the loathing for civilization that the young have been inculcated with these past several years. To these protesters, the Jewish state and Jews themselves represent Western values and Western modernity, and thus they must be raged against. Israel has become a moral punchbag for the sons and daughters of privilege, whose hatred for their own societies has driven them over the cliff edge of reason and decency. How foolish we were to think that education might deliver the young from the benighted ignorances of the past. For today it is the most educated, the dwellers of the academy, who have allowed the world's oldest hatred to wash over them. We can now see the consequences of teaching the young to be wary of Western civilization and to treat everything Western as suspect and wicked. All they're left with is the lure of barbarism, the demented belief that even savagery can become praiseworthy if its target is the West. If events at Columbia do not wake us up to the crisis of civilization, nothing will. That's Brendan O'Neill. Over at the City Journal, Invocation of a John Silber. The Campuses Have Need of You is the title of the piece by Howard Husok. John Silber, The Campuses Have Need of You. Many of you won't remember if you would ever known who John Silber was. Let me say a word about who he is. John Silber was a professor of philosophy for many years, a very well-known and respected one, so much so that a younger William J. Bennett went to study and do his doctoral dissertation with John Silber when he was a professor at the University of Texas. John Silber then went on to become the president of Boston University. He brought Bill Bennett with him to make him his dean of students at Boston University. And John Silber was a Democrat, but a very conservative Democrat, one might say, so much so that when he ran for governor of Massachusetts in 1988, he ran against one William Weld, a Republican. John Silber, the Democrat, was by all accounts more conservative than William Weld, the Republican. I suppose in the same sense that Joe Lieberman was, as a Democrat, more conservative than the Republican Lowell Weicker. He ran against and ultimately defeated. However, John Silber did not get the golden ring, did not win that election, and William Weld did. Running for governor. Did I say governor? I think I might have said senator. In any event, when campus protests took place at Boston University and the professors were egging on the students and the students were resilient, John Silber said in a Wall Street Journal interview, "I told the police, go ask the students three questions. Do you have title to the property? they built their shanty towns on our property, not theirs. Then ask them, do you have a building permit? For we have to have building permits. Then ask them, have you got a clearance with the Historical Commission? Because this is a historical district. If the answer is no to those three questions, then you tell them, we'll give you about 15 minutes to remove your shanty. And if you don't, you'll be arrested. None of them are going to remove their shanty. So you're going to have to arrest them. Because one point I want to get across to these students is I do not take them seriously. This is not some very deeply felt high moral cause on their part. This is showboating of a very insincere kind by most of these students, and I want them to understand that I see through their pretensions. That's a nice way to put it, to see through their pretensions. I suppose, too, we need to think about or rethink through this notion that education, merely giving someone an education, raises their consciousness, will elevate them out of terroristic desiderata. For example, after 9/11, there was a big push, well, we need to give Muslims better education. I don't know that that is the right answer. You can educate a man in the mind and not the morals, as Teddy Roosevelt said, and when you do that, you educate a menace to society. You think about the terrorist leaders of yore and of recent yore. A lot of them were MDs and PhDs. Ayman al-Zawahiri, the co-founder of al-Qaeda, was a physician. The Assads, the current leader, butcher of Syria, and his dad, they were physicians. When you look at the most radical elements of the Palestinian terrorist organizations under the PLO, you have doctor in front of names like George Habash and others. When you look at the hijackers and the masterminds of 9/11, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed had a degree in engineering. Muhammad Atta had a graduate degree in, of all things, urban planning. Yes, you can educate menaces to society. Education alone is not the answer. It's what you're educating students or people for. Welcome back to the Seth Liebson Show, portions of which are brought to you by our dear friends at Y-Refi. They are headquartered here locally with offices on Chauncey Lane in North Phoenix. You can visit with them. I've been there a number of times. When you do go visit with them, you won't get a sales pitch and you won't be asked to sign a thing. They leave the selling up to me. So let me tell you what you get with Y-Refi. What they have is an investment, a secure investment in a collateralized portfolio that really invests in you, flexibility and control. There are absolutely no fees with Y-Refi. With Y-Refi, you can take income, you can turn your income off, you can compound it, whatever you like. And there is no attack on principal if you ever need your money back. Of course, you get a monthly statement with no surprises. But best of all, you can earn up to a 10.25% fixed rate of return, and it's not correlated to the stock market or the Federal Reserve. Check them out at investyrefi.com. That's invest, the letter Y, then refy.com, or give them a call at 888-YREFI24, 888-YREFI24. I believe YREFI is also hiring sales associates right now as well, and they would welcome any sincere applicants. They have a great package for people who want to work there. So, good and good for you at Y-Refi, right?
And you're emphasizing that because...
As I'm looking at you.
Yeah,
yes.
Because you want me
No. But Bill is... I see Bill is putting on his fast walking socks over there. Bill likes to walk around in his sock feet. Why do you do that, Bill? Is it just, it's better on your back? To wear no shoes is better on your back? Well, that's a new one.
We got to get him a nice pair of moccasins that have no sole.
We need to
so
give him.
So it's like being barefoot, but you don't get all the germs in the ground.
You don't get all the germs. Or we could get him one of those nice standing pads so he can have a good stand here and there. Yeah, yeah. Last word on education and morals. Chaim Ginat was a child psychologist who wrote a couple of important books. One of them contained this letter. I am a survivor of a concentration camp. My eyes saw what no person should witness. Gas chambers built by learned engineers, children poisoned by educated physicians, infants killed by trained nurses, women and babies shot by high school and college graduates. So I am suspicious of education. My request is help your children become human. Your efforts must never produce learned monsters, skilled psychopaths, or educated Eichmanns. Reading, writing, and arithmetic are important only if they serve to make our children more human. Might want to send that to the administration at Columbia, NYU, and every other rotten college in the country right now. We'll be right back.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.